refugee attack that took place a short while ago in the eastern side of Al Burwayd refugee camp located in the central area of Gaza Strip, as the Israeli occupation forces opened their gunfire towards the Palestinian people who are taking shelter in the eastern side of the refugee camp. In the meantime, the Israeli attacks against the eastern neighborhoods and outskirts of Khan Yunis city were continued over the past couple of hours. We were able to hear several bombs and attacks, bombings and attacks that took place targeting those guys. And as you know, we are still talking about more Israeli cruel attacks are still targeting the Palestinian people, particularly near the so-called yellow demarcation line. And as you know, three main and focal points of those repetitive attacks, including, as you know, Khan Yunis, the eastern side of the central area of Gaza, in addition to the eastern side of Gaza. But it is really noticed on the ground that the Israeli occupation forces over the past couple of days have been intensifying the attacks against Rafah city, aiming to liquidate and unalive the Palestinian fighters who are still trapped in the tunnels of Rafah city. In the same context, the spokesperson of Hamas movement stated recently that the Israeli regime is still turning a blind eye to the initiatives that aim to, as you know, to reach a real and a significant compromisation for that issue. I mean, the issue of the Palestinian fighters who are still trapped in Rafah city. The Israeli regime is still doing what it can do, what it can does on the ground in order to kill those Palestinian people.
United Nations Children's Fund has warned thousands of children under the age of five continue to suffer from acute malnutrition in Gaza despite a so-called ceasefire. According to UNICEF, nearly 9,300 cases of acute malnutrition were recorded among children under five in Gaza during the month of October alone. The agency noted the children in the war-torn territory are also suffering from lack of adequate shelter, sanitation services, and protection from the winter cold. It stated that high levels of malnutrition continue to endanger the lives and well-being of children in Gaza. UNICEF warned situations getting worse by the onset of winter, which accelerates the spread of disease and increases the risk of death among those most vulnerable. According to UNICEF, Gaza needs roughly 300,000 tents and prefabricated housing units to meet basic shelter needs after Israel destroyed infrastructure during 2 years of aggression. It added a large volume of winter supplies remains stuck at Gaza's crossings amid Israel's ban on the entry of aid. Robert Inlakesh says that Gaza's ceasefire is designed to give Israel a break while continuing attacks on Palestinians and blocking aid.
Well, that's the intention behind this so-called ceasefire. It is essentially to give the Israelis a break from their full-scale military campaign. That means a lot of their soldiers, for instance, can, you know, go home or they can be deployed elsewhere in other regions. Of course, now they're threatening Lebanon as well. They can also focus on repairing their tanks. And whilst they do this, they can still bomb the Gaza Strip. They can still shoot civilians and block much-needed aid from coming in, as they are. Now what we're seeing happen is the United States has come in to try and save the Israelis. The United States used six vetoes to pull down resolutions calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. And of course, there is no repercussions for the United States for doing this. There's no repercussions for the Israelis. In fact, one UN resolution calling for ceasefire did pass because the U.S. Biden administration had actually abstained. That was back in 2024 during Ramadan. And it called for a ceasefire until the end of the month. The United States, afterwards, they basically apologized to the Israelis and said, yeah, it's a non-binding resolution, which, of course, anything passed through the Security Council has historically been binding. But this was a green light to the Israelis to continue just doing what they were doing, committing genocide, and nothing came of it. There's no punishment. Even the International Court of Justice, which is the top legal organ of the United Nations, its rulings have meant nothing.
Iran's foreign ministry spokesperson says the issue of Palestine remains the most universal case for justice and solidarity and the deepest wound in human conscience. Ministry spokesperson made the remark in social media posts on the occasion of the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. Ismail Baghaei said the occupying apartheid regime's genocide of Palestinians continues with full impunity that has been accorded to it by the U.S. and its allies. Baghaei noted the international community has legal and moral responsibility to support legitimate resistance of the Palestinian people to end occupation and secure their fundamental human right to self-determination. He stressed global support for Palestine should not be limited to words, but also include effective action. From Dublin to London and across to Seoul, streets filled with demonstrators rallying solidarity with Gaza and denouncing Israel's genocide. Our correspondents filed these reports.
They gathered in huge numbers in the Irish capital on Saturday to mark the UN-recognized International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. The national march, organized by the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, was backed by more than 170 Irish civil society groups. Protesters are urging the Irish government to finally pass the Occupied Territories Bill, which would prohibit Irish companies from trading with businesses operating inside illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories.
The government made a pledge that they would pass that, and they haven't. And it can't just be about goods, it has to be about services. And the people of Ireland are demanding that. We voted for it, and they're just hiding behind politics.
Campaigners say the so-called ceasefire in Gaza is a fiction, pointing to ongoing Israeli violations and a mounting civilian death toll that adds to the tens of thousands already killed.
I'm opposed to genocide and apartheid. That's why I'm here. I've been marching for 2 years and I'll continue to march.
Humanitarian aid isn't getting in, the medical aid isn't getting in the sort of amounts they need. So it's still pretty desperate, and they're getting into wintertime there. You know, it's cold enough here today. You know, so what's it like if you're living in a tent that's in tatters?
It's a sad day for the world and a sad day for America, a sad day for Britain, sad day for Ireland, that the murder machine of Netanyahu continues.
Yeah, the conditions for people living there are intolerable, and it's not a proper ceasefire, and we're continuing to allow Israel to have people living in apartheid states, and it's not right, and we're right to come out and protest and say it's wrong.
Activists are also calling on the European Union to impose robust sanctions on Israel and to ensure the Netanyahu administration is held accountable in international courts for its crimes against humanity. Because of their complicity and because they're not listening to the electorate, there's a good chance that political parties currently in government right across Europe could be punished when national elections next arise. We've already seen something similar here in Ireland. President Catherine Connolly was elected a landslide victory. She was very anti-establishment and very pro-Palestinian. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
With the Israeli regime routinely violating the so-called ceasefire in Gaza and committing atrocities against the Palestinians in the West Bank, the thousands who have descended upon central London today say the importance of expressing solidarity couldn't be overemphasized.
Well, there's no ceasefire. Gaza's still in a terrible state. The West Bank is creeping into an ever and ever worse state. And the media I'm reporting this, the mainstream media, that's why I'm here. And the least I can do is to be here in a bit of rain when people in Gaza are drowning in their tents in rain.
Organized for the 33rd time, it's a demonstration to also call attention to Britain's ongoing business-as-usual relations with the regime accused of genocide and with its so-called leaders wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes.
To see Britain and America trashing the international world order in order to support Israel as it commits terrible crimes in Gaza, it's a matter of deep shame.
To the racists in...
On the stage opposite Downing Street, they may not mention their name, but Palestine Action, the direct action group banned under terrorist laws by the Labour government for targeting Israeli weapons manufacturing sites on UK soil, is on many people's mind.
They've managed to mute all resistance all over Europe, and now if you are pro-Palestinian, you are a criminal, or you are, it's like we are losing our democracy here. It's very important to be here today, because this is a one step towards fascism, which is developing everywhere.
everyone knows is a traitor.
There's also sympathy for the six of the 24 activists jailed by the British government for trying to stop those weapons destined for the Israeli regime.
And I think in any other situation, we would hear about these things. You know, we would hear about hunger strikes if they were connected to Ukraine, maybe, or to Sudan or Congo. There's something about Palestine which means they don't even get their voices heard through the people who are trying to be allies with them here, because they're censored through.
Nearly 50 years ago, the United Nations named today the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, marking Resolution 181 advocating for the partition of Palestine into two states.
And yet another national demonstration terminates outside the halls of power, with the thousands who have gathered here saying they're here to assert that ordinary people in Britain refuse to be silent while their government continues to support a regime that is accused of genocide. Cypher is up, London.
Supporters of Palestine in South Korea joined International Day of Action on Saturday to protest Israel's genocide in Gaza and the West Bank, and to draw attention to the one-sided peace plan of U.S. President Donald Trump. The death toll of Palestinians killed by Israel reaches near 70,000 people after 2 years. We're reminded to look past the data.
It's been so long since the current genocide started, and we just see numbers and numbers and numbers, and we forget that these are individuals, and these are people, and they have families, and we need to remember that, and we need to remember the suffering of other people across the world, and how we need to stand up for all of them.
As supporters of Palestine here have emphasized, responsibility for Israel's genocide is widely shared. South Korea continues to deepen ties with Israel, including hosting the Israeli ambassador for public events and expanding military cooperation, including the provision of components for Israeli fighter jets that are still bombing Gaza. Under the cover of a so-called ceasefire, Israel's killed hundreds of Palestinians and has again widened the conflict with deadly bombings of Lebanon and Syria. While now most countries have shifted to support Palestine, more active policies are needed.
Countries need to impose more sanctions, and they need to put more pressure on the country that is aiding Israel, being the U.S.
Recent winter rains have destroyed thousands of displaced Palestinians' tents. The U.N. demands Israel allow Palestinians to receive much-needed humanitarian and food aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Hamas has categorically condemned Israeli forces' escalating raids and abduction of Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. The movement also slammed Israel for giving extremist settlers a free hand to terrorize Palestinian citizens. Hamas said the escalating of violations by Israeli forces and settlers across the occupied West Bank amounts to war crimes, stressing the main goal of the regime's incursions are to implement West Bank annexation plans, Judaization of the territory, and displacement of its local residents. Hamas called for urgent action by the international community as well as Arab and Islamic nations to force Israel to stop its crimes against Palestinian civilians and halt continued violations of international law and the rights of the Palestinian people. A senior Hamas official also slammed Israel's escalating violations in the West Bank as part of an official policy to terrorize and displace the occupied territory's residents. Mahmoud Mardawi described regime's attacks on Palestinians as state-sponsored terrorism carried out under direct political orders from the extremist Israeli regime. And earlier we spoke to our West Bank correspondent, Naga Hamed, for an update on ongoing Israeli raids across the occupied territory.
Today, the Israeli forces announced that they will be ending the military aggression against the province of Tubas, which has lasted for 4 days, and more than 170 assaults and 170 arrests, fieldly interrogated and beaten. More than 60 Palestinians have been hospitalized due to severe beatings and severe inhumane treatment by the Israeli forces. The Israeli forces have decided to withdraw from Hamoun, yes, but it's clearly, they are clearly escalating elsewhere. In Jenin, the Israeli forces are continuing the demolitions that they have started in yesterday. New 24 homes have been demolished by new military order, and the escalation around Jenin is quite noticeable. Over here in Ramallah, as I'm speaking to you, an incursion is being made towards Albida city, and of course Bethlehem and Al-Khalil are on the same page. Many attacks and incursions have happened throughout the day. Khalayil al-Loz also were raided in the provenance of Bethlehem. Attacks, of course, towards the south of occupied Al-Khalil is also continuing and unfortunately deepening and even expanding more and more towards more of the Bedouin clusters of Masafer Yatta to the south of occupied Al-Khalil.
Venezuela has strongly condemned the U.S. President Donald Trump's announcement about the closure of its airspace and a surrounding South American country. Caracas described Trump's remarks as a colonialist threat against Venezuela's sovereignty and a violation of international law. The Venezuelan government says such statements constitute a hostile, unilateral, and arbitrary act incompatible with basic principles of international law and the U.N. Charter. It added Venezuela will continue to fully exercise its sovereignty throughout its airspace. Iran's foreign ministry also slammed Trump's statement as blatant violation of the most basic norms of international law and international aviation. Ministry spokesperson Ismail Baghaei described Washington's move as illegal and provocative, warning it poses an unprecedented threat to the safety of international aviation. He stressed U.S. measures also have serious consequences for the rule of law, as well as international peace and security. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio.
On November 20th, inside a packed IAEA Board of Governors meeting room in Vienna, a familiar drama played out once again. With 19 votes in favor, the European Troika, joined by Washington, pushed through yet another resolution demanding that Iran fully and immediately expand cooperation with nuclear inspectors. The text calls on Tehran to hand over precise data about its 60% enriched uranium stockpiles and to open the gates of its nuclear facilities to agency personnel, among many other demands. But Tehran saw this coming. Iranian diplomats had warned that any new hostile measures would reflect Western political ambitions, not nuclear facts. And they point to what they call the real trigger for today's crisis: the June attacks on Iran's safeguarded nuclear facilities carried out by the United States and the Israeli regime. Once again, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has become a convenient stage for political theater, pressure that has never succeeded in stopping Iran from pursuing its legitimate nuclear rights. It's a game that seems to never end. That's how Iran frames the IAEA's approach, a process designed to keep Tehran in a permanent limbo until it yields to Western demands. Russia, China, and Niger voted against the resolution. 12 other countries abstained. The split vote underscored a truth everyone in the room already knew: the board is deeply polarized and nowhere close to consensus. In a joint statement, 8 countries, that is Belarus, China, Cuba, Iran, Nicaragua, Russia, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, condemned the U.S. and Israeli attacks on Iranian nuclear facilities and denounced the push for a new resolution. They urged member states to resist politicizing Iran's nuclear file and reject the draft entirely. While the resolution ultimately passed, the combined 12 abstentions and 3 no votes revealed what Iran called a gap between reality and truth inside the agency. Dr. Afifeh Abedi, a prominent journalist and foreign policy researcher, provided us with her analysis of the vote's composition.
It appears that the resolution adopted by the Board of Governors, with a very narrow and fragile margin, as you know, it received 19 votes in favor and the combined number of votes against and abstentions was almost the same, can once again be described as a political move designed to serve the maximum pressure campaign pursued by the West and the Zionist regime against Iran.
Tehran went further, describing the resolution as an unconstructive attempt by the European Troika and the U.S. to compensate for their failed snapback attempt at the U.N. Senior political analyst Dr. Hossein Kanani Moghaddam offered further insight into the resolution.
The core content of this resolution is to impose a 3-month deadline, after which the case would be referred to the UN Security Council, enabling the Council to pass a resolution against Iran and take action. If we think of this resolution as a nuclear reactor, the core of that reactor, in terms of impact, is that it confirms the snapback mechanism, reinstates the 6 previous resolutions, and once again alleges Iran's lack of cooperation. It does not call for the suspension of Iran's nuclear activities, but for their complete shutdown. It also reinforces the requirement for Iran to return to the safeguards agreement it accepted and signed in 2003, an agreement that is binding and legally enforceable because it clearly outlines Iran's obligations. This resolution effectively revives Iran's file, which was close to being removed from the Board of Governors' agenda. It states that in every upcoming board session, Iran's nuclear case must remain one of the items on the agenda.
The irony, Iran notes, is that the IAEA itself has acknowledged the very real consequences of the June attacks. Normal safeguards were disrupted, inspectors were withdrawn, and Iran, saying it acted in good faith, still allowed verification activities to resume at facilities unaffected by the attacks. Grossi's own report recognized Iran's domestic legal requirements and affirmed the agency's commitment to respecting Iranian security concerns. Yet the sponsors of the resolution barely mentioned any of this. During special board sessions, they avoided reference to the attacks entirely, even though the IAEA's official report documents them. The EU, speaking for its 27 members, stressed that diplomacy is the only viable path forward. With 6 UN resolutions reinstated, the EU said all members are now obligated to require Iran to suspend all enrichment, reprocessing, and heavy water activities. The Union insisted Iran had sidestepped its JCPOA commitments for 6 years and that its enriched uranium stockpile has ballooned to nearly 50 times the JCPOA limit. Mr. Hassan Beheshtipour, a senior political analyst, placed the recent resolution against Iran in context.
These resolutions are essentially a continuation of the nuclear case-building process against Iran. Since August 2002, Iran's peaceful nuclear activities were turned into an international issue, and from that point onward, it has been called Iran's nuclear file, while in reality it's a manufactured file. This case was created for Iran, and one of the main platforms where this case building happens is the IAEA and its Board of Governors. The importance of this resolution is not simply that another resolution has been issued and Iran will not implement it, so it does not matter. It does matter because they are creating documentation against us. When a country is discussed and voted on in a 35-member body, and an 8-paragraph text is issued as a ruling, that text becomes another sheet added to the previous ones. Iran's file at the Board of Governors includes over 120 Director General reports issued every 3 months and more than 40 resolutions. The resolution adopted in this recent round is effectively the 10th in the latest phase. From an international standpoint, the problem is that each new resolution becomes another documented claim layered onto the previous ones, strengthening their narrative. The other key issue is that this gives Germany, the UK, France, and behind the scenes the US and Israel a pretext. They can now cite these resolutions as justification for taking new actions or imposing additional measures against Iran.
According to EU claims, Iran holds more than 440 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium and over 10 significant quantities of highly enriched material. Some of this, they allege, has been unaccounted for over 5 months. With those accusations on the table, the Troika defended their decision to activate snapback, reviving 6 old UN Security Council resolutions and using them as a legal basis for the new joint resolution with Washington. What is the significance of the recent anti-Iranian resolution adopted by the IAEA, and what would be the possible repercussions?
One of the outcomes of this resolution is exactly the document building process I mentioned earlier. They are trying to create legitimacy for actions that are in fact illegitimate. When a nuclear site is operating under IAEA supervision, like Fordow, Natanz, or Isfahan, the agency issues detailed reports on them every 3 months. These facilities are inspected, transparent, internationally recognized, and engage in peaceful activity. So when such sites are attacked, that attack is an illegal act under international law because it targets facilities under IAEA oversight that are in full compliance with the NPT. Yet they attempt to justify this unlawful behavior through the very resolutions issued against Iran. Even before the Zionist regime's attack on Iran, a resolution had already been passed, and these resolutions are then used as political cover. In other words, they are manufacturing legitimacy. Under international law, as long as a site is under IAEA supervision and complying with the NPT, no state has the right to attack it. But through these resolutions, they try to turn the situation into a political asset, using it to increase pressure on Iran, push for further isolation, discourage other countries from engaging with Iran, and build negative media narratives. They create a wide range of storylines around these issues. Yet, when you look closely, there is not a single piece of evidence, according to the agency itself, that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons.
On safeguards, the Europeans argued Iran has delayed verification of enriched materials and failed to implement several NPT obligations. They also insisted that Tehran submit a special report on the damaged facilities, grant access to key sites, and resolve what they call unresolved issues. Unable to meet their own JCPOA commitments, the Europeans now accuse Iran of failing to restore trust and transparency, particularly regarding enriched uranium stockpiles. Dr. Kanani Moqaddam stated that the West's hidden agenda is to overthrow the Islamic Republic. What do you think is the real reason and motivation behind the European Troika's action? And basically, do you think there exists a hidden agenda contrary to what they state and express?
The overarching plan the West is pursuing regarding Iran is essentially a Libya-style model. The idea is to first dismantle Iran's nuclear capabilities and remove its equipment, then intensify pressure on Iran's missile program and regional policies, After that, NATO and the UK would be in a position to carry out military action with ease. And as we saw in Libya, the result of such a model is a country that becomes fragmented, loses its sovereign authority, faces a power vacuum, and is stripped of its capabilities, gaining nothing in return.
We have a lot more to cover today, but first let's take a moment to catch up on the latest headlines.
Hello everyone, welcome to the news section of this program. Here we'll go over some important news headlines. First, Iran condemns draft resolution by US E3 at IAEA BOG. Iran's permanent representative to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Reza Najafi, censured a draft resolution proposed by the United States and three European countries at the IAEA Board of Governors, calling it a bid to impose unjustified and illegal reporting obligations on the United Nations Atomic Agency's Director General Rafael Grossi. The anti-Iranian resolution at the IAEA Board of Governors will not change Iran's status of safeguards implementation, Najafi said ahead of the upcoming BOG meeting, which took place from November 19 to 21 in Vienna. He argued that Washington and the E3 are once again trying to manipulate international mechanisms in order to impose their unreasonable and coercive positions on the Iranian nation. Forcing Grossi to base reports on expired UN Security Council resolutions is not only completely unlawful and unjustified, but will also, in practice, increase existing complexities and deal another setback to diplomacy, the Iranian diplomat added. Iran warns of countermeasures against illegal IAEA resolution. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said Tehran is considering more countermeasures against an illegal resolution adopted by the International Atomic Energy Agency regarding the country's peaceful nuclear program. Ismail Baghaei made the remarks on November 21, one day after the IAEA's 35-member Board of Governors passed the anti-Iran resolution put forward by France, the UK, Germany, and the United States. In response, Tehran announced the termination of the deal it signed in Egypt's Cairo in September to resume cooperation with the UN's nuclear watchdog. The ties had been suspended after the deadly US-Israel aggression against Iran in June. Baghaei said in an official letter to the agency, "We declared that the so-called Cairo agreement, which had been reached with Iran's goodwill and after relatively long negotiations with the agency, is now cancelled. Other measures are also under consideration." Tehran Times. MPs ponder response to IAEA's anti-Iran resolution. The National Security and Foreign Policy Committee of the Iranian Parliament categorically condemned the recently adopted anti-Iran resolution by the Board of Governors of the International Atomic Energy Agency after beginning the process to devise an appropriate response. Ebrahim Rezaei, the spokesperson for the committee, dismissed the resolution as politically motivated and illegal, highlighting the need to show a strong and deterrent reaction to the move. He made the comments following an extraordinary session of the committee attended by Iranian Deputy Foreign Minister and the Deputy Head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran. Rezaei had previously suggested that Tehran leave the NPT. This session was held in order to review the IAEA's recent resolution against the Islamic Republic of Iran, he explained. IRNA. Russia anti-Iran resolution by IAEA BOG is a serious blow to credibility of agency. Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Maria Zakharova said that Russia considers the anti-Iranian and provocative resolution of the International Atomic Energy Agency proposed by the Western camp a serious blow to international confidence in the IAEA safeguards and the nuclear NPT. Reacting to the vote of the IAEA Board of Governors on the draft resolution on the NPT safeguards agreement with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Zakharova said that there is no need for emergency action by the IAEA Board of Governors regarding the verification activities in Iran. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokesperson pointed out that the IAEA Secretariat had not requested any instructions from the IAEA Board of Governors. She said that Russia recognizes Iran's continued adherence to its obligations under the NPT and the Comprehensive Safeguards Agreement with the International Atomic Energy Agency, despite the U.S. and Israeli attacks on its nuclear facilities under IAEA safeguards in June. And thank you for joining us in this section. Please do stay tuned for the main narrative. For many years, Iran's peaceful nuclear program has been the target of political pressure and Western allegations. Before the JCPOA, the possible military dimensions file became the centerpiece of sanctions and threats. But when that file was formally closed in 2015, the pretext disappeared, albeit for a while. After the JCPOA was signed, Iran complied. The United States did not, walking away in 2018. Europe, meanwhile, never delivered the economic benefits it had promised. In response, Iran exercised its JCPOA-defined rights and scaled back commitments. 7 years of diplomacy followed. Iran says it approached negotiations in good faith. Western governments, however, responded with delays and ever-increasing demands.
When the Zionist regime carried out its illegal attack against Iran and its nuclear facilities, European countries not only refused to condemn it, they even expressed satisfaction. They particularly welcomed any adverse event that might occur in Iran, whether targeting nuclear sites or even affecting Iranian civilians. This clearly shows that the concerns the West claims to have about Iran are not technical at all. They are entirely political. There are numerous precedents for this. Consider the nuclear agreement. When the United States withdrew from the JCPOA, Europe, despite its explicit commitments under the deal, did not activate the snapback mechanism against the US, nor did it uphold its promised cooperation with Iran. In one of the joint meetings about a year after the US withdrawal in 2019, the Europeans made a series of commitments during the session with the JCPOA Joint Commission, yet they failed to fulfill any of them. They even pretended to introduce certain initiatives to preserve the agreement and deliver the economic benefits Iran was supposed to receive, but none of these materialized. In practice, Europe's conduct after the JCPOA and following the US withdrawal demonstrated that they were playing a complementary role to the United States. Europeans maintained a diplomatic facade of commitment, but in reality they sought to ensure that only Iran remained bound to the agreement, while Iran received none of the benefits it was promised.
On November 20th, Iran's foreign ministry condemned the new resolution as illegal and unjustifiable, imposed under pressure from Washington, London, Paris, and Berlin. Hours later, Iran's foreign minister announced that the Cairo agreement between Iran and the IAEA can no longer be implemented. Tehran notes that 5 months earlier, a biased IAEA report helped clear the way for the June attacks carried out by Israel and the United States. Even then, Iran continued cooperating. Back in September, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi made a new inspection agreement in Cairo, only for the European Troika and the U.S. to revive snapback once again. Supported by Russia and China, Iran rejected the process as legally invalid. From Iran's perspective, the West's decision to activate the snapback killed the Cairo agreement outright. Now, Tehran says that the U.S. must answer one basic question. If U.S. President Donald Trump claims that he destroyed Iran's nuclear facilities, then what exactly does the West want to inspect? The new resolution seeks to revive demands from long-expired U.N. resolutions requiring Iran to suspend enrichment. According to Iran, the board has no legal authority to resurrect terminated Security Council measures. The Troika's attempt to imply such authority exposes bad faith and disregard for IAEA procedures. To Tehran, the text reads like a manifesto of threats aimed at restricting Iran's strategic capabilities, a project championed for decades by the U.S., Europe, and Israel.
Iran has several possible courses of action. The first is a snapback against snapback approach, meaning We raise the cost of such measures to a level that Europeans reconsider exerting pressure on the Islamic Republic. Part of this relates to energy, and part of it concerns international waterways such as Bab el-Mandeb, the Persian Gulf, and the Indian Ocean. Iran has the ability to raise Europe's energy costs to a point where some governments, already facing economic crises, may regret entering a game designed for them by the Americans. In parts of Europe, there are still rational actors who do not wish to follow U.S. policy line by line. The second path is through diplomacy. We must continue dialogue and emphasize our right to the peaceful use of nuclear energy, a right recognized under international law and accepted by all. We're still within the framework of the NPT. We have not withdrawn, and we should maintain this course to reach a balance between pressures and resistance. The third option is reaching a point of no return, moving the nuclear program to the edge of breakout, enriching up to 90%, conducting a nuclear test, withdrawing from the NPT, and disrupting the regional order the United States seeks to impose. But entering such a path could lead to a conflict whose scope is unknown, including whether it could escalate into a global war.
Yet, Iran emphasizes a key point. Not one IAEA inspection report has ever accused Iran of blocking inspectors. Not one. Before the attacks, Iran had the highest inspection rate in the world. Nearly three-quarters of IAEA verification activities in all safeguard agreement states occurred in Iran. In 2024, the IAEA conducted 1,381 inspector days there. Among 32 countries operating without the additional protocol, Iran, with only 3% of global enrichment capacity, accounted for more than 70% of all inspections. But while Iran's transparency has been unmatched, Israel, armed with an undeclared nuclear arsenal estimated up to 400 warheads and never a member of the NPT, operates outside any inspections. UN Resolution 487 demanded that Israel place its facilities under safeguards. It never has. The result, from Iran's perspective, the IAEA is no longer acting as a neutral arbiter. What was meant to be an impartial watchdog now appears to function as a vehicle for Western political pressure.
In short, Israel has not accepted the NPT, whereas Iran has. Israel is a member of the IAEA, but it has never signed the agency's most fundamental treaty, and because it has not signed it, it does not consider itself bound by it. So why is there no pressure on Israel? Because it's an ally of the United States, Germany, the UK, France, and other dominant powers. In today's world, international law is not what truly governs. Power does. It is power that shapes international relations. That's why Israel, backed by the US, the UK, France, Germany, and others, can simply refuse to join the NPT, remain a member of the IAEA, and at the same time possess more than 300 nuclear warheads. Why cannot Iran do the same? First, because they would never accept it. Iran has fundamentally challenged international order and the existing balance of power. Iran views this system as hegemonic and domineering and is in confrontation with it on various fronts, including the nuclear issue. So it's clear that they will seize on any pretext, including the nuclear file, to prevent Iran from operating outside the NPT framework, even if those activities are purely peaceful. For them, this is a convenient instrument to maintain pressure on a country that has dared to challenge the existing international system.
After 22 years of allegations and political maneuvering, the IAEA Board of Governors' latest resolution confirms that the agency is no longer an independent supervisor. It is an operational arm of Western policy, applying pressure, issuing threats, and advancing a strategy of containment. Tehran views the resolution as the final, unmistakable sign of a system no longer aligned with fairness, impartiality, or the principles of the non-proliferation regime. We asked Dr. Abedi to outline the possible scenarios that lie ahead. What do you think would be Iran's next move?
It seems the United States and Europe are once again trying to pull Iran back to the negotiating table, but for an unfair agreement, one based on their imposed conditions. One of the key conditions they insisted on in the past and continue to insist on today, despite its illegality, is stripping Iran of its right to uranium enrichment. This, in fact, is the most optimistic scenario. I personally believe there is also a more pessimistic scenario, that the West is not actually seeking oversight of Iran's nuclear program. Rather, they want additional intelligence about the facilities that were attacked and about enriched materials buried beneath them, so they can complete the sabotage of operations previously carried out against Iran's nuclear program. Even in the optimistic scenario, their aim is to shut down Iran's nuclear program and reduce it to whatever level they consider acceptable. There is also a third scenario, neither a new agreement nor a military strike, but instead an escalation of maximum pressure on Iran. To intensify this pressure, they seek a legal mechanism. The Board of Governors resolution is essentially an attempt to give legal cover to the unjust pressure they want to impose. Iran is familiar with all these scenarios and has prepared itself accordingly. Over the past two decades, and even after the Zionist regime's recent attack, Iran's primary effort has consistently been to follow a legal and legitimate path, cooperate with international institutions, and rebuild international confidence in its nuclear program, not merely the confidence of Western governments. In my view, the most likely scenario is that Iran will once again pursue a legal process to disrupt and counter this Western strategy against it.
That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Until next time, take care.
I've trusted you a thousand times, but you always bring me back to the same place. My heart is moaning, but you can't hear. What do you care about me except my face? You think you know everything? You think you're enough? But sometimes a tiny virus ruins your life. You have so many heroes, but only in movies. I've tried all you said. It's time for the help.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We have been discussing some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature. And I'd like to ask you, Sheikh Javid, a question regarding that. Of course, you kindly provide us the answers to these questions of jurisprudence based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. My question, or first question, is regarding tajafi, a kind of half-sitting that some people, people who are offering their prayers, the Muslims who are saying their prayers, do. What is the law, the Islamic law, regarding this kind of sitting?
Well, tajafi means, as you rightly mentioned, it is a half kind of sitting. When, for example, the imam is in the second rak'ah and you are in the first rak'ah, you cannot sit in the same way as the imam or other people who are performing their second rak'ah. So yes, you just sit in between, standing and sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is recommended that you sit in that posture.
Right.
Okay. And it's not wajib. If you happen to sit down, still your prayers is in order. It's valid. And you can keep doing the jama'at prayer
mm-hmm.
with the imam.
But if you sit in the same way as the imam,
yes,
or the rest of the actually...
Your prayer is not made void.
Uh-huh.
Your prayer is not, it is still valid. And you can keep praying with the imam, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But tajafi is recommended. It's not wajib.
Right, I see. A lady asked us, what is the Islamic law regarding the illicit gains of our husband? We know that, for example, our husband's salary or gains and wages, in fact, come from illicit sources.
Right.
What can we do with that?
That's a very good question. Well, the religious authorities have stated that it is allowed, it is permissible for a woman to receive whatever is given by her husband. And it's not necessary for her to investigate and to see whether the amount given to him was obtained or received from a halal source or not. Because, okay, let's assume that maybe 10% of a man's income is halal, and the rest is maybe haram. Okay. Now, his wealth is mixed with halal and haram.
Right.
The money given to the wife is halal for her. She doesn't need to check to make sure that the money given to her is halal. Okay. Whatever is given by the husband is halal. And this is the opinion of the religious authorities, including His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei and Grand Ayatollah Sistani. They have said whatever is given by the husband to the wife, is halal, and she can use it.
Yes. There was an assumption that there is a mixture of halal and haram source,
yes,
in the salary or gain of the husband. But what if the husband's, in fact, main source or all that the husband actually receives is from the theft or robbery? It's not mixed with anything else, which we call halal. It's always haram, right?
For the wife, it's permissible to receive and to use whatever is given by her husband. Even though she knows the husband commits theft, she earns haram money, but it's not necessary for her to find out whether the amount given to her is halal or haram.
I see.
Because it's not, she is wajibun nafaqa, and she is entitled to the money given to her. Okay, maybe the amount received by the man, maybe he received from another man that was haram for that man. So how can you find out that that money was basically haram or halal? The money is itself not to blame because it's a piece of paper given to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Shavit. Let's take a short break and then we'll be back momentarily after this break.
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, also in this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, what is the law or Islamic and Sharia law regarding women's fasting or the wife's fasting without the husband's consent?
If it does not violate the husband's rights, conjugal rights, it's okay. She does not need her husband's permission to observe fast.
Right.
But okay, if the husband wants her to be available for the husband, for him, and she brings up an excuse telling him that I'm fasting, I cannot be available, that's a different issue. It's not permissible in that case for the wife to observe fast, and she must obtain her husband's permission. So depending on the scenario, depending on the condition, if it does not violate her husband's rights, legal and Sharia rights, then it's okay, she can fast without his permission.
I see. Okay, and what about the Sharia law regarding offering the prayer without muhr? We know that the Shia, school of thought requires people or Muslims, while they're offering their prayer, they have a piece of soil, usually, something that they call muhr, right?
Yes,
a piece of clay,
yes.
Right? And then they, when they prostrate, they have to put their forehead on it, right?
Mm-hmm.
During prostration. So if any Muslim does it, or a Shia, for example, does it without the muhr, is his prayer valid?
Right. Well, generally speaking, it is necessary for a duty-bound person who offers prayers to do sajda on anything which is allowable,
mm-hmm.
and anything which is part of the surface of the earth. It could be a piece of clay, and preferably a piece of clay obtained from the land of Karbala, from the earth surrounding the chamber of Imam Hussein alayhi salatu wasalam. Okay, but okay, anything which is considered to be part of the surface of the earth is allowed for prostration, like leaves of tree, like grass, like stones, like wood, cement, and
even cement.
Yes, of course.
Which is a processed one.
It's okay. It's part of the first. It's not mineral, okay? But what is forbidden is mineral like gold, like metals, like anything metals, okay?
Mm.
And then anything which is edible, like eating, you eat it. For example, vegetable which people eat, like chive, like leeks, like coriander. These are vegetables people eat.
What about the carpet?
Carpet, it's not permissible.